There's the man.
There he is.
How's it
completely
going,
ready for this video segment of Remainders.
I love it.
Looking good.
Hey, thanks, man. You too. I love it. You know, I'm getting excited. So we're at 20 episodes now, which is fantastic. I love it. And I love the surprise I get seeing a different painting of yours every time we show up on camera, because they're always immaculate. And I love your freaking work so much. And this Batman one is just talking to me right now. So.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, you know what? That's what a cool thing to get, like, the opportunity on these videos to showcase, you know, some art. And I figured it could be a little bit of a revolving door, because I've got so much that I created for this next show that I'm going to be doing here in July. But that's got to wait. We'll have that on future episodes, because I haven't put anything out into the universe yet, just yet, or online, or whatever you want to say. So this is a little bit of the older work. But one thing I will say, this is sold. This 1 year after I painted it, we sold the tacos, and I am so excited for it to go to a new home. But, like, it's always a little sad when you sell a painting, because, you know, like, you get really, like, attached to these things. So it's the swan song for the 90s tacos today.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. I also like how I agreed with you about that, you know, once you sell a painting, and that feels like, I've certainly never sold a painting, but I just nodded in agreement. Like, I know that feeling myself. So
I don't know, maybe it's kind of like when you lend a book out to somebody. Is it lend or is it borrow? I never know which one.
I think both are applicable. Yeah.
Grammatically correct, whichever, insert whichever one is correct. But yeah, I think, like, I don't know. I would think you would be a little bummed if, like, that book never made its way back to you, because you become attached to it when you read it. Is that right?
Well, I mean, we're talking about something you created with a book that I've read. So definitely not a totally equal. Your piece is a little bit more important. But yeah, no, I got you there. Like, I kind of always have the assumption that I like to forward books. I mean, I love giving people books. That's my favorite thing to do. And on rare occasions, like, unless it's like a specific copy that I have, like, my notes in or something, I would obviously be like, yeah, I definitely want this book back. But I don't know. I kind of have the assumption if I'm giving somebody a book, you know, it kind of becomes theirs, and, you know, it may make its way back to me. But, you know, like,
that's,
I said,
interesting.
I mean, turning people onto books is one of my favorite things to do. So that's like, I'm okay with kind of having the idea of just pushing it out there to somebody else.
You know what? I know that about you too, because you've talked to me about that before, and I've been the recipient of some books that you've gifted me in the past as well. And speaking of making notes in books, I do the same thing. And I think you're right. It becomes a little bit more personal when you're making these notes, especially on a book. Like, I have a borrowed a book on emotions and how to sort of deal with what is going on in your mind and body. And this book is pretty fascinating that I'm reading right now, but my girlfriend borrowed it to me, right? So she's got all of her notes and everything she's underlined that she thought was important to it. So it's actually kind of interesting for me to read it and take it in as I would for myself, but then also kind of think about her and, like, why she underlined what she liked. And, you know, then kind of knowing her demeanor that all these years later, after she read the book, like, how is she actually applying some of these things? You know, it's actually kind of amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree. I mean, that's one of the best parts of sharing books is that connection that you have, like, seeing what you can understand. Sometimes you don't even understand what you got out of a book. You know, I think of, like, a couple different books, like that Guide to Stoicism that I know you have, and I can think of a couple novels that, like, I know what I've gotten out of it, but I'm always intrigued to, like, learn, like, what other people get out of it, you know. And that's what makes it so much more interesting, is when you kind of get that light shed on it when you may not even realize something of it.
Well, speaking of connecting things, that's what we do here at Remainders, right? So anybody who's just joining us and likes the movie Under the Silver Lake, The reason we're here is to talk about that film, and that Patrick has no clue how I feel about it, and I have no clue how he feels about it. So we're going to discuss it. But before we do, what we like to do is share a little bit about our lives and what we're doing so that you guys can get to know us and our likes and dislikes. And I think one thing Pat wanted to talk about today was going to see comedy, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we started talking about the George Carlin doc. I think that's a good place to start because I loved it, and it sounded like you did too, and that it definitely covers a lot when it comes to stand-up. But yeah, no, I mean, like, I just was like so engrossed with that documentary. I had no idea about his a lot of his personal stuff. I mean, I feel like that's kind of my MO anyway. It's like I don't really pay too much attention to people's lives, even for like figures that like I enjoy, like their personal lives sometimes doesn't like always appeal to me, but like his struggle with drugs when he was younger, it's obviously nothing I was even around for at the time, but like that just was like so illuminating. And because like I came to him like later in life, like a lot of people like our age, like when he was already an old man, like railing against the system in his style of comedy. And that's how I've come to love and know him. And so learning about his early life was fantastic.
Yeah, you know, I did love that documentary, and Judd Apatow did that. And then he also did another two-part series on Gary Shandling that I didn't know about. So I'm not the biggest Gary Shandling fan, and I don't really know much of Gary Shandling's work, but it was sort of in the same style and kind of interviewing people that had known him. And my girlfriend actually had told me to check that out too, if I liked the George Carlin one, which I did. I thought the George Carlin one was just absolutely fantastic. Same. I didn't know much about his personal life. I only kind of knew the HBO special. Not that I had HBO growing up, but my friends did. And I would always watch HBO George Carlin. He had a ton of them. It seemed like he was the king of it, right?
Yeah.
When you think about these comedy specials these days, and like, you know, Dave Chappelle, who's constantly having them come out on Netflix and things, and now everybody does, right? So it's kind of like he was like the first person to do it that way. And it was always later in his career when you knew him as sort of this, what you thought was like kind of spout off at the mouth about things that he kind of disliked, and not that he was a curmudgeon so much, but that he kind of was just going to tell you how it was, you know? And I think people love George Carlin for that. And then what you get in the documentary is a lot of George Carlin's life that you just didn't know. Like, again, the alcoholism that he dealt with his wife, and the drugs in his life and everything. But again, it's not like it was like social media where he wanted everyone to know all that stuff. You know, he was on the road and going out and like making sure people saw his comedy. And that was what we got. And that's what he wanted you to get. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I agree to all that. That's fantastic. But like, yeah, it's the social media aspect is why he's like so relevant today in those kind of
right.
5-10 minute bits that he was doing, you know, 20-30 years ago, that are still like, people are just like, hey, this was 30 years ago. And it like, it literally applies to today in terms of like a police state or abortion or religion and government. And I think that's why like this document is kind of blown up for a lot of people, is because he's so popular among young people who are, you know, maybe have been born after he passed away.
I think a big part about it is that we know this George Carlin with the beard and everything like that, sort of like Willie Nelson, where all of a sudden Willie Nelson became known as a pot smoker, long haired beard, long beard hippie. But what people don't realize about George Carlin and Willie Nelson is that they started out sort of like adhering to the system of the times and how they were supposed to be in the genre that they wanted to travel down, right? So comedy and music. And so very straight laced starting out. And as time came on and as the world started to unfold to them, they became themselves, and they were brave enough to become themselves. And I think that that's the part why people are sharing George Carlin snippets online, and why everything is so big now, is because like any great artist, if you're true to yourself and if you are honest with your audience and don't try to fit into some sort of mold that isn't you, you'll have life forever. You'll live forever. And I think that's why he's so relevant and so popular now, is because the greats always live on past their time, when there are people who sort of reinvent the genre based on their originality and their ideas.
That's fantastic. I love it. Yeah. I mean, especially with him, I think a big part is because he, certainly like the last half of his career, I mean, the whole thing, I guess, he always was attacking ideas and never like people. He never, I forget, I'm paraphrasing somebody point, phrase it like this, but he never like punched down on anybody. He never made fun of a group of people. He made fun of ideas that groups of people subscribe to, but he never was derogatory in any way of like specific people. It was always the idea behind what they were subscribing to. I mean, he's on multiple quotes, like, and he says it in the movie a lot. He just hates groups, essentially.
Right.
You know?
And if you think about that, like, yeah, because everybody
get together on an idea rather than like, you know, by any other faction.
Yeah, that was super interesting part of the documentary to me. Super interesting. And I think that that can be blown out to so many different things in the world today, right? Organized religion, when people get together and flock together, it can kind of be a bad thing, is what he's saying. You know, people change. You're not really, you're swayed by other ideas and not your own sometimes that way.
Do you feel like he was genuinely full-on pessimist at the end when they covered him, like with that last special, where it just seemed like he went off a complete, a different side of just really antipathy towards humanity? Or do you think, or do you feel
I don't
like
know, it was interesting. Kind of a, I don't know why he would say end. That. I don't know why he would say that at the end of his life, unless he really meant it.
I mean, if anybody was going to be genuine about it, it would have been him. So.
Yeah. I mean, kind of at the end, I was like, yeah. Why, you know, why hold anything back now, you know? Right. And it's interesting, man, to kind of give up on the human race. And, you know, that's kind of what you get out of it, you know?
But he still wasn't given, like, he certainly wasn't, he never gave up on people, like,
no,
you know, individuals no. or anything. But yeah, he, if you see the documentary, yeah, there's a, they definitely cover the last special he had and just kind of like a lot of the stuff he said the last couple of years in terms of sounding very fed up with humanity.
They did such a great job directing that last montage too, with everything that's happening right. in the world today with this. So beautiful, right?
It felt a little manipulative, but I was all for it though. So I was still behind it for sure. So
sure. I mean, in a way that maybe the Joker with Joaquin Phoenix felt a little manipulative at times. Like, I want to make sure you know what this is about, you know?
Right. Well, we're getting a musical with Joker 2 now. So I'm all in for that. So
yeah, pretty crazy, pretty bold. And I am all in for that. Anything Joaquin Phoenix, I'm always all in for. Well, should we talk about this film that was literally filmed in my backyard over here in Los Angeles?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to be talking about Under the Silver Lake all day. I saw, I want to keep on the stand up for a second. I saw Sarah Squirm last week. Are you familiar with Sarah Sherman?
Oh,
Sarah
man, Squirm? I am so sorry. That's right. We're talking about going to see comedy. We went crazy on the Carlin documentary. I'm not familiar. And so Pat and I are going to talk a little bit about what we saw, what we've been seeing comedy-wise. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, no, it's fine. I was just, I caught her. I was completely unaware of her, but I ended up going to a show at Sleeping Village in Logan Square. And she wasn't on my radar, but it was fantastic. Sarah Squirm, she's basically like a body horror. She basically does body horror comedy, a lot of like shorts for like Adult Swim and stuff. I mean, she was doing a show in Chicago for like 8 years. So obviously I was missing, my comedy friends were not pointing her out to me. I was not aware of any of her stuff, but she's been on Saturday Night Live for like this whole past season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I remember, well, so.
I don't know her name, but I guarantee my girlfriend does. She's the big comedy person. And nice. The reason why I go to these things is basically because she knows a lot about it.
Yeah, no, yeah, she's done pretty well on Saturday Night Live this past season, because it's, so I have not watched Saturday Night Live in years. I've seen maybe like 20 sketches over the last decade. But it seems like her contributions are pretty throwing a wrench in the machine because of like how original they are. And I'm not saying anything bad about the show or anything, but you know, I don't hear too many people kind of talk up Saturday Night Live all the time as being the most edgy comedy out there anymore. She did a great job at Sleeping Village. I would definitely recommend checking her. I mean, her comedy is like, it's definitely absurdism to a T. So if that's up your alley, I definitely recommend checking her out.
Awesome. Yeah. For me over here, the last three things that I've done that I think are noteworthy to mention are, the first one was seeing Natalie Palamides. Do you know who she is?
No, I don't think I know that name.
She had a special on Netflix called Nate. Had you seen that?
Nope.
Okay. So she did this special called Nate, and she's been getting a lot of traction for that, amongst other things. She's really great. Yeah, I think you'd love her. But she had been doing for the Netflix's Joke Festival out here. At the Elysian Theater, we went and saw a new thing that she's doing called Laid, and remarkable as well. I'm not going to speak too much about it because I have a feeling she'll probably do a Netflix special for it, since she had so much success. She's also in the Progressive commercials these days, and it's really cool to see people kind of like their rise, you know, when you go to see them and they're, you know, performing in front of 20 people, and then, you know, all of a sudden you're seeing them on commercials for big insurance places next to John Hamm at a table, and you know, pretty neat. So we went and saw her, and then Laura Keitlinger, right down the street at the Lyric Hyperion, somebody that my girlfriend likes a lot. And we saw her in front of five people on a Wednesday night, Tuesday night, it was last week. And she was cool. You know, I loved it. It was nice. It was nice to be in front of people that kind of were all there to just laugh, if that makes sense. And the place was really cool, real small. Again, neighborhood place. Felt good to support the local art scene, which is something that I feel very strongly about. And then one other thing I just want to mention, I'm like falling in love with this guy. Do you know the artist Rex Orange County? This is not comedy related, but it's just an artist, a musical artist.
I've heard that name for sure.
Well, Rex Orange County is like my new favorite singer. He has these great songs and a new record called Who Cares that he just put out. And we saw him at the Hollywood Bowl, gosh, like 2-3 weeks ago, when he was coming through town. A friend of mine works with him, and so we got to go, and I was just blown away. You know, it's cool because it was sold out, the Hollywood Bowl, super iconic. I saw Morrissey there in 2019, and that was like the best show I've seen, right on. Kind of next to the Ramones. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And then seeing Rex Orange County over here at the Hollywood Bowl, Morrissey didn't even sell it out, I don't think, but Rex Orange County did. And he's like 21, super nice guy. I got to meet him for a second backstage. He was like one of the coolest performers. It had this very uplifting kind of positive message in his songs. And there's all of these people that are younger, you know, than me, of course. And they're just like going crazy over this guy. And I just thought, this is like where, like, I'm glad to see for once. And I don't have to be like such a, guy who gets bummed on the future of the younger generation anymore. Cause I was like excited about like a younger guy doing the music he was doing with the kind of message that he had in his songs, and that there were so many people there to watch it, you know? So it was kind of like a really positive night. I just thought I'd talk about that in case anybody's never heard Rex Orange County. Check out Rex Orange County. Awesome stuff.
Nice. Yeah. It looks like he's collaborates with Tyler, the Creator.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. So that's cool. Right on. Love it. Yeah, I haven't been to too many shows lately. The Strokes are playing down the street actually for me tonight at the Metro, which
rescheduled because somebody in the touring company got COVID. But right. I told Tom our drummer right away, I was like, you have to go to the Metro to see the Strokes. They're playing. And I think it's like they're supporting a political candidate. Is that right?
Keena Collins. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
That's cool. Oh, is he going?
He's going. Are you going? Oh,
no, I'm not. Yeah. I didn't end up committing to it. It was, I mean, the tickets were a little pricey, and they sold out like in an instant. So I kind of slept on it anyway. So that's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen him a couple times before. So But I mean, yeah, seeing up the Metro, that's by far the venue to see them now. So,
yeah, I'm going to see a band called Pansy Division. Do you remember them back in the day?
Yeah, I remember that name. Yeah.
Like my growing up life of seeing bands at the Fireside Bowl, they'd play there all the time. And the coolest thing about that is that, like, you know, it's like 98, 99, seeing my favorite bands. And there's this like queer band that comes through and it's Pansy Division. And they're singing about, like, you know, being in love with guys and having sex with guys. And the whole audience is like queer. And it was such like a cool thing because, I don't know, not to get off on a big tangent before we get into the movie here, but I'll just say why I'm excited about seeing them in LA is because, like, I feel here just like so much more, like it feels a lot more open than it did, but it was nice growing up in punk rock for me because I feel like bands like that, like, were accepted for sure. And it helped the audience accept like those kind of things and things that were different, you know, especially in the Midwest, you know? So I kind of always loved them for that. And like, I remember seeing Green Day would be on tour and then they would bring Pansy Division with them. It's like Green Day was getting huge and Pansy Division was like the smaller band on the same record label that they started at. And like, they kind of started to gain some steam. And like, I had not seen them since back in those days. Right. Like, and then I saw they're playing down the street from me on July 1st. And I'm like, I fucking can't wait. I'm going to go and I'm going to have such a good time. It's going to feel like I'm a kid again.
Oh yeah. What's the venue? Is the one you like?
Oh gosh, no, I've never been there before. It starts with a Z, Zebulon it's called. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
So I'm going there and I'm excited about seeing Pansy Division. And then my favorite band, one of my favorite bands, Murder by Death, is playing in July as well. They got a new album coming out, so I'm going to see them too.
You are stacked up with awesome shows coming up. I'd love to hear it.
I got to feel the inspiration, you know?
You just opened a whole can of worms for me that I've been thinking about. This is, maybe that's a good segue. I've been thinking about a lot about the way we consume movies lately. We're not going to get too meta on this, but you know, you and I are a big fan of like Ebert, Siskel and Ebert, and watching movies through a critical lens. And I love the difference between watching a movie critically and then watching it for inspiration. And maybe just to illustrate this really quick, it's there are two ways to watch a movie, like critic or you watch a movie like Quentin Tarantino. Like critics love Tarantino, but they'll make fun of the movies that he loves. You know, he released his top 10 favorite movies of all time a couple years ago and critics were like mocking him for it. And yet they're the same critics that like appraise his films. And so it's just like, it's clear that these 10 movies that he released or and talked about, they were the ones that inspired him the most. Rather than the most like critically acclaimed films out there. So that's just something I've been thinking a lot about.
That's interesting kind of too.
That's
interesting too from Tarantino, where you've seen those clips, I'm sure, where he talks about like, if you really love film, just if you really love film, he's not talking about anything technical.
Yeah.
He says, you know, don't worry about the lens that you're using, you know, don't worry about whatever, don't worry about any of that technical stuff. Just go and make a movie, you know, use your iPhone, whatever. Like, it's going to come out good if you really love film. And I think that's like such a great thing for all art, you know, like everybody's always so worried about having the best paintbrushes or the best guitar or whatever, the best recordings. Really, at the end of the day, it's like what you're making will be good if you really love it. And you, you know, you do it with like a lot of, you know, heartfelt meaning for you. The audience will see that.
Right. And again, it goes back to like viewing something as an artist, reading something as an artist and kind of having that experience rather than, you know, criticism is always going to have a role, but if you're inspired by something, that's honestly the height of the artistic experience.
I think it's a great thing for you to open up with before we start this movie, because I think that's actually the way that I'm going to talk a lot about this movie. But I want you to start it off because this is your pick. I had been wanting to see it because, like I said, it's kind of based around where I live here, location wise. But you picked this film. Why did you pick it?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a big fan of this film. Yeah, this movie has a lot of people who are just not into it, which I totally get. Like, this is like a confounding film that. You can definitely make the argument that it just wasn't as successful as the director his name's escaping me, David Robert Mitchell, whether or not he was successful in what he was trying to do. But I get why people are just totally not on board with this. You know, it has like tons of people who are fans, but, and I'm certainly one of them. I love it. But yeah, I mean, it's a neo-noir set in LA, and it covers Sam, who's basically on a pursuit to find a missing girl. And that's kind of the extent of the plot. But within all of that is essentially a movie about code breaking and whether or not the movie itself is an actual code that you can figure out and break itself. So I think that kind of like sums up like on the most high level of like what this movie is and kind of like why I love it so much. And, you know, we can get into a lot of the stuff into it in terms of plot. Again, like I don't think we have to like talk about plot from start to finish because it goes in a lot of different, it's basically a labyrinth. And so I don't think even that would be a useful way to go about it. But again, I think it really is like Andrew Garfield's performance is what I love the most about this movie. Essentially playing a crumb bum, but it's a crumb bum who's experiencing depression and he's looking for meaning in his life through this pursuit that he may or may not find meaning in. And I'm pretty excited to hear what your thoughts are, because again, this it definitely has its detractors, but has its fans, and I'm definitely one of them.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot since I've seen it, which wasn't very long ago, but I've been thinking a lot because, you know,
it's a slow burn. So yeah, I'm excited to hear what you say. And then maybe we could even like talk about it, you know, in the future, because this is a movie I've seen multiple times and it's a lot to take in.
Yeah. And so I feel like, you know, I think it's great because you're going to get my initial reaction. I've heard about this film, of course. And again, been really excited to see it because of the location. I'm not the biggest Andrew Garfield fan, I have to say. So it wasn't like a big deal to me that he was in it. I didn't even know he was in it, to be honest with you. And it's kind of an interesting role for him. And I don't know where it fits within like the Spider-Man stuff and everything that he's been doing, but like, obviously he's killing it. I saw him in that Eyes of Tammy Faye movie recently. And I'm just kind of like, okay, this guy is like pretty versatile, you know, like he can play a lot of things and he just seems to be getting these cool roles. And this is an interesting one for him. And I almost watched it thinking, is Andrew Garfield know somebody in this? Like, were they able to get him on board because, you know, he has friends or something? And I can't imagine anybody read the script and understood it, but, you know, that's just me, because it's not like anybody can really understand this film. And I don't mean that in a mean way. Like you said, it's like, maybe I need to watch it like 8 more times to truly understand like what's happening here. Cause as it unfolds, it's a lot to take in. And my initial reactions are that it was cool. And again, I watched it less of a critical lens and like you said, more of like a fan of movies, you know. And starting out, the very first scene opens in like, you can see the ice cream shop that I go to with my girlfriend on the weekends. So like it's on Hillhurst in here in LA. And I, so to me at first, seeing like your hometown is like, whoa, this is amazing. Like this is right where I live. And that, after that, it kind of that wore off for me. And for me, location is such a big deal in films. And this was like a little too much. It was like a little too, and maybe that's the point. I don't know. But again, if I'm just going to say it how it is, it felt very like, look at me, LA. Like all the locations were just like, hit you over your head. And I moved here because of that stuff. So, you know, like I'm not criticizing that at all, but like, and if you're going to get someone into a story in a film, maybe if I wasn't so close to this location, then maybe it would make sense in the grand scheme of things in the movie. But like, I don't like, I like seeing films where I'm like, oh, that was filmed over here at Little Dom's, or this was, you know, like, but it's one thing. It's not like the whole town. So like I wrote some stuff down here. So it opens in Hillhurst next to that Jenny's ice cream, and then the Ferndale the park, which is like another place that I walk to every Saturday or Sunday, and I'm like, and he's in that scene like all the time, and like I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool to see it on film, right? their John Marshall High School, I believe. He's at Cinespia, which is another super LA thing that people do, which I do. I love it, where you go and like see movies in the cemetery. So he's there, and there's a lot filmed at the cemetery. All the locations are so LA, even Echo Park, which, you know, it was like famous for the Chinatown scene where they're in the boat. And the old LA Zoo, I believe. And he's at the observatory, of course, too, when he goes to the James Dean sculpture, and a lot of other things as the movie goes along. But like, that's a lot right there. That's like super kind of kitschy, like hipster LA, you know? And again, I think the movie for me would have been better if like there were locations that I didn't quite know so well. Maybe that was the point, was to make them really, really well known. I mean, you always see the Hollywood sign in the background. And then I have to think, well, like, what does the locations have to do with the movie? Like, if it is done for more purpose than just to be the cool LA stuff, like, is it something to do with the character? Does a character feel trapped by the city itself? Is the city a character in somehow that relates to the story? And maybe you have thoughts on that, Pat. So, but this is what I was coming through with as I was watching it, because it was such a big part of the movie. This location has to have something to do with the film other than just being cool. And then the other thing that I noticed was, and I've been like thinking, like, is there a better word to say than wank fest, you know? So like, I don't want to say, oh, it's a wank fest for like locations in LA. Okay. I don't want to say that, but that's kind of like, tell me like a better way to say it, but that's what it is. It's like a wank fest for like these locations. And then it's also
masturbatory.
Okay. It's masturbatory in the filmmaker's love of directors of movies. I mean, I was saying like, there's so much voyeur Hitchcock stuff, especially early in the film. That scene where they go into driving through, I think he's on Griffith Park Boulevard, and he's going down like to John Marshall, and he's like watching. It's like stripped straight out of Vertigo. Mm-hmm. And then you talked about it earlier. This is so David Lynch in the way that you have to put the puzzle pieces together. It's like Mulholland Drive in a way, you know. I remember having the Mulholland Drive DVD and like having to like, there were like clues about what the movie's about in the DVD, like insert and stuff like that. And even to the point where you had Patrick Fischler in this, which is also in Mulholland Drive. He's like also in Mad Men, which I know you haven't seen, but he's amazing as the Utz guy in there. And then I'll just say that? A couple, I'm sorry. His name is Patrick Fischler. You'll know him when you see him, look him up. You probably don't know his acting name, but he's like a total character actor that's in like everything.
Which character did he play?
He's the one who gets spoiler alert, gets killed.
Yeah. This guy's great.
He's great. You gotta see Mad Men, dude. You would love him in that. Okay, but let me just finish and then I'll let you go on to your stuff, because like these are just my initial random thoughts. I wanted to make sure I pulled out a couple other things. I mean, I definitely noticed Brian De Palma in there. There's like some force majeure stuff that I noticed was very De Palma. Did it feel like Brick to you? Did it feel like Rian Johnson's Brick to you at times, where it's kind of like this kind of like caper?
Got my notes that say I need to watch Brick right now. So
Brick is fucking outstanding film. Yeah. I love Brick. Yeah. Watched it recently. That movie, light years ahead of this film, if you ask me. But anyway,
we don't have to do any ranking right now.
No, but Rian Johnson killed it with that film. And then there's even some Darren Aronofsky stuff, like where early on and like Requiem for a Dream stuff, which I don't remember. We used to like shit on Darren Aronofsky all the time back in the Suncoast days.
None of those conversations.
Ben and I did, I think. But it was more so because it would always be like talking about, look, Mom, I made a film in college class, is how Ben used to say it. I didn't feel exactly like that. But the camera rig on him when he's running Andrew Garfield was, I thought, very stylistically Darren Aronofsky. Why am I saying all this? I felt like it's either this filmmaker like is totally inspired by all of these things and is just like throwing randomly what he's inspired by in the film, or he's like legitimately just like thinks it works for the film. I don't know. All I know is I've seen some of this stuff before.
Fair. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm not hearing that as a bad thing, though.
No, I'm not. I guess I'm not really saying that any of this is a bad thing. It's just like again, if I'm watching it for like the love of film and a love of like LA, yeah, then I love those locations. Like, I, to be honest, the story I could not follow. Like, what the hell was going on? So, you know,
right.
These are the things that I pulled out.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, just to set it like a foundation, I don't. My personal opinion is you're not supposed to understand. Like, it's a code that's not supposed to be solved. And I was texting you about it. I honestly think David Robert Mitchell is basically trolling the viewer into figuring something out. Because everything, once you start going down any rabbit hole, you'll find a contradiction or you'll find a solution that actually doesn't have any bearing on anything. And so that's obviously kind of like a broad way of talking about it. You know, we could talk about examples, but again, like, it is so deep and convoluted in terms of like, who's this dog killer that's running around the city? One theory is that it's Sam, that he's the actual dog killer. Who's going missing in terms of these billionaires who are just the impetus of the girl going missing? Is that a billionaire goes missing? And Sam suspects that this girl that he met, Sarah, played by Riley Keough, Elvis's granddaughter, and his suspicion is that the billionaire may have something to do with it. Codes within music, which gets to one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is when he meets
favorite scene of the whole fucking movie. Absolute.
The songwriter is so fucking good in this scene.
So good.
Yeah. Sam.
I'm so glad you said that. I knew you would too. Absolute favorite part of this whole great movie.
Yeah. Sam starts getting to, and this was only halfway. This is a long movie. This is like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it need to be 2.5 hours long? I mean, Jesus.
Well, you know, do you need peanut butter and chocolate together? No.
Okay.
he gets to the songwriter in a mansion. It's only halfway through the movie. It, like, in my memory, like, I've seen this movie probably like 4 times, but it almost like feels like close to the end of the movie, but it's like, time-wise, it's only halfway through. And it gets to a songwriter who, you know, we don't have to give too much away. We could talk about plot, but like kind of go around it. But essentially, it's a theory that the songwriter has been instilling codes into the music, which was confirming Sam's, Andrew Garfield's theory all along. He says it right at the beginning when he's talking to his like semi-girlfriend. It's like his theory is that there are messages that the rich are putting into TV shows and whatnot to talk to each other. And the songwriter, it comes out that he's been the one writing all the hit songs. He's playing his piano, like Pixies. He gets to Smells Like Teen Spirit. And he basically is admitting that he's been the one putting messages into these things, telling people what to think, and all he's doing is profiting from it. It's one of my favorite lines. It's like, he says, I wrote Smells Like Teen Spirit here, somewhere between a blowjob and an omelet. There is no rebellion. There is only me earning a paycheck.
That's why at that part, and that's such a great line. You're absolutely right. This guy, I wish I knew the actor's name to give him props right now, but he was so good. And he's just like, it's almost like nonstop the way he's going into all these hits that we know, and he's playing little ditties of them on the, you know, piano and saying that he did all this. But that's where I started to think, well, maybe there's a reason why Hollywood is in this, like, and it's always so in the forefront, because like, maybe that's the thing, is like, Hollywood's a lie, right? Like, everything you think you know is a lie. And I don't know, I don't want to be too analytical about it. I don't know if that's like part of the theme of this film or not, but I wanted to think that maybe it had something to do with why we're seeing so much of Hollywood after I saw that scene.
Yeah. I think that's valid for sure. And I think it's valid because there is no right or wrong. I truly believe that there is no actual code to be broken, and that Mitchell's intention was to create something that couldn't be solved.
So there's actually nothing under the Silver Lake?
Well, now you're blowing my mind. So no, but yeah, it just kind of goes back. So like, again, with the dog killer, he may or may not be the dog killer, whether one even exists. There may or may not be codes in all the music. I love Topher Grayson's movie, by the way. He's so awesome. He's just tagged as bar buddy, I think. But he's like this Zen Buddhist, all-knowing LA guy that just
kind of miss him as Topher Grace if you know you didn't.
Oh yeah, really know. He's got the beard and the earring and the hat and the hipster glasses the entire time. And yeah, there's a couple. I think it was only like his last scene the first time watching, I realized it was him. But he's got so many good lines that basically tell you what the movie's about, and then the rest of the movie is like basically challenging that and refuting it. Like some of his lines when he talks about there's no more mystery in the world, and that's all we do is crave mystery because there is none left. Or they're sitting at in that scene when they're outside of his house with the drone and they're looking into the girl's room, which is like, it's like such a
crying.
It's the sleaziest scene ever. They're like, yeah. They use this drone to look at this girl undress, and she just sits down and starts crying, and they just slowly just like, all right, I guess I'll go, because they're just like, oh geez, like we're pieces of shit right now.
Right. Well, I don't know if I don't know if Topher Grace was. I think he was fine with it.
But yeah. Like, yeah, they like it just like the scene just goes dead. It was like, you guys are assholes. But when he's talking about like how the role of technology and what it does to our brains these days, and again, it kind of goes back to the overall theme that I think this movie's about. It's that Andrew Garfield is just a guy who's experiencing depression because he broke up with his girlfriend, which may or not actually be true. Although he does meet somebody he resolves and gets a little closure with at the end. But it's Andrew Garfield experiencing depression and using this entire labyrinth puzzle to solve as a distraction to his own depression. Like there's a line when he's at one of the LA parties near the beginning, right before he meets the balloon girl. It kind of sums it up. He says, it's hard to know what a person will do when they're in pain. And I like, to me, like that, like kind of just sums up like the entire, not necessarily the what the movie's about, but like what his character, what was driving his character right then, like through the entire movie. He's in pain, and so he's literally just going to distract himself with co-breaking whatever garbage theories he may be coming up with, and just everything to find this girl that he's only known for like a couple hours.
Kind of reminds me of that great Joe Strummer line that I just like think about a lot when, you know, you're at your worst, and is something, I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, a man is at his most dangerous when he has nothing to lose. Isn't that true?
Ain't that the truth? He certainly has nothing to lose. He's basically getting threatened to be kicked out of his apartment the entire movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you can see it like in his right after there's a scene where like he comes out and he finds his car is getting marked up by a group of 14-year-olds.
That and scene fucking rules too, because everybody wants to be the everybody wants to be Andrew Garfield at that point.
He beats the shit out of these 14-year-olds. Little 14, like they are
okay. So I gotta
barely
ask,
14.
Did like, of course, you know, it's pretty traumatic, but wasn't it like, fuck yeah? Weren't you as a viewer like, fuck yeah, fuck these kids? Weren't you like, didn't you feel that?
Yes, until you see his face when he's beating the shit out of it, which is like, you can see the rage in it. And it's a clear shot, like it's intentional. You're looking at his face and you could tell he's fucking releasing rage at that moment.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And
but I mean, you feel like sure, these little kids, shits deserve it.
No shit, but like they're getting it from somebody who's already in pain and just reacting to them drawing a giant dick on his Dodge Charger.
You know what? That's a great way of saying it. Somebody who's already in pain, you know, because at that point, like, I'm not sure the audience really truly like understands why he attacks them so hard. You know what I mean? Like, obviously he sees these kids doing this, but like who in their right mind is going to go beat the shit out of them for it? You know, like as hard as he does.
And again, this kind of goes into everything's a contradiction of everything else. He is in pain, but Sam's a Sam's a fucking piece of shit character. Like, he's not like somebody you're actually kind of rooting for, or really, he's not that likable. Even as he seems like a tough hang, and he's just he's a piece of shit for the most part. And so that kind of like makes it hard to actually sympathize with him as somebody who's like going through depression. So again, it's just everything in this movie, like I said, I've seen it several times now, like everything contradicts everything else. And that is honestly what I love about it, but I fully get why people are kind of turned off by that. And this, like I said, it is divisive. People have, I mean, this is kind of one of those movies where like you either love it or hate it. And I've definitely seen that reaction from the few things I've read. And, you know, I saw this at the Music Box when it first came out, and kind of hearing people talking about it. And
what year was that? Do you remember?
2018.
Okay. So it's a pretty new movie.
Yeah. It's not too old. I mean, so maybe a little context, David, Robert Mitchell, David Robert Mitchell, he's got three movies, but the one he did before this was It Follows.
I didn't even look, I love that film.
That's, he had one film before that which I haven't seen. It didn't seem like it got like a huge release. The Myth of the American Sleepover. I'm not sure how big this was, but I haven't seen that. But It Follows, I'm sure a lot of people have seen, because that's definitely a good one. You like that one?
I mean, yeah, and that had a purpose for sure. You know, and like what a cool way to twist that into like a horror film, you know.
And so I remember like there was a lot of you know, not necessarily disappointment, but just like what kind of follow up to It Follows is this movie? It confused a lot of people. Like a lot of people are, I mean, if you watch It Follows and then you hear about the director who is his follow up to that, and then you watch this, you're like, I this is out of left field. I don't even know what to think about it.
It's making a lot more sense to me now that a lot of you know, the star power that's in it, and also what, you know, just some fascination with REM songs in this film as well, which that couldn't have been cheap to get, right? So now it's making a lot more sense that the director had a hit on its hands before this, you know.
I love the needle drops in this movie. I mean, like, there's tons of great music, but it's obviously very 90s centric. I mean, it covers, I mean, that's from start to finish. She's obsessed with Kurt Cobain from the very beginning, while they're fucking looking at his poster, talking about how Kurt Cobain's daughter signed the poster.
Like, you couldn't get Kurt Cobain to sign it, so
No, that needle drop with the REM song when he's dancing with the balloon girl in that club is I love that scene. That's definitely one of the aesthetically, it's one of my favorites, because that's such a great song. And I love that she invites him down. Oh yeah, it's old music night in the Crip Club, and it's 90s music. It's like, oh yeah,
yeah,
90s is old music now. So.
True. Yeah. yeah, there's a lot of.
Are you an REM fan?
Yeah, I mean, again, not like
your voice went up there, dude.
Yeah, yeah. If you hear somebody say that, you're like, no, you're not really a fan, are you? It's not like I'm not. That's the thing. It's not like I'm not. I like when I heard those songs, I was kind of like, oh, this is cool to hear this song again, but I'm not going to go put the record on, you know, that kind of thing.
All right. Well, I put the record on after hearing it, so that's cool.
Well, you know, everybody's allowed to like one bad album, I guess. No, I'm just kidding. Hey, I have respect for REM. I know a ton of people love REM. I just kind of don't realize, like, I never really followed their career. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it was before. I mean, they've been around. They were peaking by the 90s. They've been around forever before then. So,
you know. I mean, you know, you're not going to put on "That's Me in the Corner." That's me, you know, you're not gonna put that on and like not love it. Like, you know, there's something about that song, like it's the mandolin, dee 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 dee, you know. I don't know.
I mean, I'd rather just listen to you sing instead of Michael Stipe. So
I mean, I kind of like the bands you can kind of like mimic their like voices when you hear it. Like I guess that's how you know a band's good, right? Like, it's like they're just so unique. Like, he's got a cool voice.
Stipe is where it's at. Love it. But they also have that song from White Town, which was like a huge hit. No, I shouldn't say it was
Your not Woman, a huge right? Wasn't yeah. it Your Woman? Yeah, I exactly. love that song.
That's that song. Like my sister and I were like obsessed with that song, like when it was like big on Q101 here in Chicago. So,
dude, there's a great lyrics in that. I guess what you say is true. I could never be the right kind of girl for you. Yep. Right? That's awesome.
Yeah.
And that's from a guy singing for perspective, yeah. you know?
That's a true one hit wonder. I saw not much.
White Town.
Is that what I said?
White Town is the name, right? White Town?
Yeah. 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 No, that's the name of the band. Right? Yeah. No, I love that song. It's so great. It was on, I took a deep dive through best songs from the 90s on the Spotify playlist, and that showed up when I listened to it a couple years ago, and that was one of the more memorable ones for sure.
I mean, I'm not sure if you realize, but Dua Lipa sampled that on like one of her biggest hits.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That do, 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 do. That's like she sampled that part, I guess.
Are you sure that wasn't Star Wars?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
So I mean, I'm okay with getting you to sing every song that we talk about on this podcast. Maybe that
oh god is be- that going to become a thing?
I think that's a worthy segment.
I gotta sing somewhere. Well, yeah. I haven't played a concert in over 2 years now. I mean, come on already.
Yeah, no wonder everything's so bleak. We need some scissors. We need some scissors and TLB live performances. Come on.
Hey, I wanted to say, I saw somewhere, maybe it was on Instagram today, right before I got in here while you said you were going to be late, you posted something.
Calling me out to the audience that I was late.
Oh, well, sorry about that. Yeah. But you were, yeah. Okay, you know.
Guilty.
And I was scrolling really quick, and I saw something you posted, but it was from Fran Lebowitz. Is that, did you just watch that documentary? I don't mean to get off of under the Silver Lake, but just really quick, did you watch that today?
We're pro tangent. Okay. We're okay with tangent. No, but I mean, I saw it when it first came out, and I had just come across the quote, and I had never posted it. So that's why I put it on there.
I wanted to say one thing about that I love from that documentary. We never talked about it, and I don't know if like it's something we would ever talk about on here, but she has something that she talks about in there about social media and everything that I did talk about this with you, but it's such an important thing that I loved. And she said, you know, these days everybody's on social media and they're a singer, they're an artist, they're a musician, and they don't have anybody telling them that they're no good. Everybody's telling them, oh, keep it up. Don't give up. Keep going. And Fran is like basically saying, like, somebody should tell them you're no good. Go and be something else, because it's ruining people's lives, because they are getting this false sense of self that they're like this great singer and they're really not. But social media, like, it almost works the anti-bullying, you know, if you give people too much accolades for things, it's like it can ruin their sense of self or who they think they are. And I just love that. That's what I took away from that Scorsese, Fran Lebowitz is her name, right? That's yeah. what I took away from that.
Yeah, no, I mean, the documentary is great. She's a great writer. I saw her just like 2 months ago speak at the Roosevelt Auditorium here in Chicago. Which is great. She just does like crowd work these days. Like she's very vocal about the fact that she just does not write anymore. And so she basically does all these appearances, and Marty doing the movie for her was obviously pretty big because that blew up. But she spoke for like a little bit, and then she just did crowd work for like an hour and a half, where she just took questions and she's comfortable with like whatever that comes up, and then she goes off on her tangents against social media, like you said, against why people don't read books anymore, and not in like a bitter way. Like she's pretty popular with the younger generation because she's appropriately critical of, I don't know, you know, she doesn't come off as like too condescending. Maybe a little bit, but
yeah, it's always like kind of like with a wink, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, if you could do something with charm, you can get away with most anything, I guess. So,
well, getting back into Under the Silver Lake, I did think that at the end, I mean, the main character, Andrew Garfield, finally does find who he's looking for, this girl that he had a one night fling in his apartment with. And she's kind of like, oh, you were looking for me? Like, that's what the audience is thinking the whole time, too. Like, there is no meaningful connection between you two. Like, why did you have to go and find this girl? And why is it, was that the mission of the movie, was to find you? And now that you have, what are you going to do about it? And she's like, cry. There's like a tear coming down, though. There's a moment in that that I took out of it. If for anything else, I wondered about the Hollywood thing again, to go back to it, because he says, well, are you going to stay there? And it's basically like some underground bunker or whatever. And she's like, well, I guess I'm here now. So like, what else is there to do? And there's like a tear that comes down. And I was like, fuck, like, are they saying something about like, well, I'm here now in Hollywood and maybe it's not what I thought it was going to be, but what else is there to do but just keep trying? I don't know. What did you think of that?
No, I love that phone call between the two of them at the end. I mean, I mostly got that as like him getting closure, not necessarily with her, you know, like you were saying, like it's, they didn't even know each other really well, but him getting closure for like his own shit, you know, her saying that line, what was it again? It's like, well, I'm already here, so I might as well make the best of it.
Yeah.
And you could see like a light bulb or like something clicks in his face when she says that. And you can tell like he's, you know, it's like, yeah, I have everything in my life has been shit, but I am gonna like make the best out of it. And again, that's pretty simple messaging, but like in terms of like them talking to each other in that phone call, I love the way that's shot.
Yeah, totally. And you know, weird that he's in some tent with a bunch of like weird people in the middle of the mountainside, but that
they're ascending to a better life that doesn't involve the garbage. What is he, garbage of like chasing a little bit of money and a new car?
that's kind of an amazing line.
yeah, they're, you know, they're done with the material world, and so they're gonna, you know, find a better place in a bunker. So
I think like for social media, when I post about this, I'm just gonna write, was this movie any good, ? And like see what people say, you know. Again, like, I'd love to hear other people's reactions about this film. Like is there any articles out there about like what it's about that we could look at? I don't know if anybody, like you said, has the answers, but I'd love to know, like, people that listen to this podcast, what they think, if they've seen it, you know. Like, that's truly something that I think we could benefit from, is like opening up like something about like when we talk about these, hearing what other people's think, because like other opinions like really can sway your opinion about what you had just watched. Like, I'm learning a lot about this film just talking to you about it and what you've experienced, you know. So if you're out there, let us know what you think, you know. Send us a message. What did you think of Under the Silver Lake?
Yeah, I expect a lot of detractors and a lot of defenders. Like I said, seems like a film that has plenty of both, which again, I always have the most fun watching those movies. So did you notice the comic book store guy? Did he look familiar to you at all at the beginning when he's talking to the awkward comic book store guy?
He's at the last bookstore, right? Which is that famous bookstore here in LA. I didn't know if he was like a real employee or not. He didn't really look familiar to me.
He was an actor. He's in The Greasy Strangler, which I don't know if you've seen.
I have not.
Okay. It's a movie that's out there, and it's appropriate for his performance. That's another one I would love to hear people and their reactions to. But yeah, I wasn't sure if you caught that one.
No, yeah, that flew by me.
All right. So what other scene? So you said the songwriter, that was your favorite scene?
Oh yeah, I love that scene. It was just amazing.
So what was the other Hitchcock reference? There was that one where he's at the cemetery.
And yeah, sees, you know, it's funny because that's at Hollywood Forever, and that scene there's the three actresses were actually call girls, I guess, are against a headstone, and that is there at Hollywood's Forever Cemetery. And I've heard that that's just like a, I don't think anybody's buried there from what I've heard. I don't know for sure, but it's just like a homage to Hitchcock, the film director, which is my favorite director. But I don't know for sure. That place is awesome though. I go there all the time. It's right down the street from me. I walk in there. There's something to see all the time. It's got the coolest people buried there. And those cemetery screenings at Cinespia are cooler than cool. Like at what we're going to see, the fireworks there. We're going to see Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Oh, yeah. July 4th.
Well, there was that. So it's right after, it's the very end of that scene where it's a close up of his face and then the girl's face on the screen.
Oh, that's the force majeure thing I was talking about with it being very Brian De Palma.
Oh, okay. I missed that. Sorry. Yeah, that's, I loved seeing that.
You know what I mean? With like De Palma will constantly, like, something should definitely be like blurred out in the background, but then he makes sure. Yeah. That, which is exactly what he did. And you know who steals that a lot, especially in his segment in Death Proof. He steals a lot from De Palma, and it's Tarantino.
Influenced stealing. I mean, De Palma's
straight stealing, like score and everything.
Was there
like
ever that. A shot in Hitchcock, in a Hitchcock film, with that kind of framing?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. So what we're talking about to the audience who's listening, force majeure being that like something in the background would be superimposed in very clear, instead of like when it should be blurred, it'll be very clear. And it's basically like a splice into the frame so that you can see two reactions from the character and the other character in the background, basically. So that was a very interesting choice to do it there. That's what I mean, like, why did that happen in that point? It didn't really seem like it had any kind of meaning to me, unless it was trying to like make sure that the audience knew that this person's in the movie that he's talking to right now. I don't know.
I think he just liked the style. You know,
well, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's why I think it was like a kind of a wank fest for like, you know, directors that he loved. That's what I thought. I do have one other thing that I want to say, and I kind of don't really have anything else to say about the film, in my opinion. I did like it. Don't get me wrong. It just wasn't something that I can really, with one watch, I think really pull out too much of like what it might be about. And so it's easy to talk about it maybe aesthetically than it is plot wise. But this might've been I don't know if the director is from Chicago, if has any Midwest ties or not, but did you notice the old style shirt, the old style Chicago shirt, which I believe was like from the, like an old marathon, Chicago marathon shirt that Andrew Garfield is wearing?
No, I missed that.
It's very hidden. He's wearing a cardigan over it, and it's like awesome drawing of like the Chicago skyline. I caught it immediately when it flashed on the scene. It's during the scene when the escort's in his place and she grabs a piece of tomato pie pizza, which is also a pizza place right down the street. He's wearing a Chicago old style marathon. I believe it's the Chicago marathon shirt. I wish you could see the whole thing, because it looks super awesome and vintage. And it, to me, it was kind of like, that was a choice. Who was from Chicago that was like, you got to wear that shirt, you know?
Yeah. I was noticing his cardigan in that scene, because it looked exactly like Kurt Cobain's cardigan.
Totally. Yeah.
Maybe. So I got distracted by that one, I guess.
Gotcha.
Love it. Okay. Well, I'm happy you liked it. Yeah. You don't have to like any of these shitty movies I suggest.
No, I mean, I liked, again, I was going to watch it anyway. And it was on my list. So I'm kind of glad that we had an opportunity to talk about it. Sometimes it's like, for me, your style can differ from mine. And I think that that's a good thing for our podcast.
Well, I mean, that's what I love doing this. We'll be talking about movies we think you should watch, but if one of us has never seen them, we're not, it's going to be a first time viewing for one of us, which is going to be actually next week, not to get too ahead of us, but what are we watching next week?
It was La Piscine, right?
Yeah, that's right.
La Piscine. I don't know if that's exactly how you pronounce it, but it is the swimming pool. And I'm excited about that. I know you said you haven't seen it.
No.
Yeah. Oh, get ready for the sexy, man. This is a sexy film. You're going to love it.
Love it. I'm excited to watch it, man. It's great.
I know. I picked some super, super weird ones. Like, you know, I have a feeling that those are going to be like our least listened to episodes. But if there are people that love film, they'll like it. So.
Well, I mean, I expect some breakneck switching up, because we're going to watch something like this. And then right after that, who knows, maybe we'll watch like Alligator. And,
yeah, exactly.
Because I mean, that's the best part of having these conversations with you is the variety in our styles. You know, I mean, you are far more into classic Hollywood than I am. Not in terms of like me disliking anything about it. I'm just not as well versed into it as you are. And then I can school you on 80s horror movies right after that. So I think,
I mean, for sure. And again, you know what? Sometimes for me, and maybe it's good for any of our listeners out there to find yourself a friend like I have in Pat, because, you know, I can get a little elitist in my case. Let's just say it that way. I can definitely go down the road of like, my nose is in the air, classic Hollywood, like it's all art bullshit. And that's why, like, going into and talking about some shitty 80s movie that you love, and, you know, we don't exactly know why, is really good for me. It's really good for me to like have some fun and like not take everything so, to be so brainy and so analytical, if that makes sense.
Yeah, shitty is a subjective term, because I know we're going to do Cobra at some point. So.
You won't let me call your movie pick shitty, and I like that too.
Yeah. I'm looking at this. I just love this tagline for this review of La Piscine: pretty rich people behaving poorly.
And I'm already,
I'm already on board for that.
I just want to tell you, and we can segue out after this, that film I watched after I had surgery last year, and it was like, just look cool. Like, there was a really cool like still from it on Criterion. I had no idea about it, but yeah, it looked like two cool looking people, and I'm like, I'm just gonna check this out, you know, like, let me see what it's about. I'm not like a person that's gonna go like watch foreign movies just to watch foreign movies, but like, I usually find something pretty amazing when I watch films that aren't American. And when I, after I watched it, it was like how it was with Vertigo with me.
Right.
It like affected me in a way. Mulholland Drive was that way too. Like, these movies that you watch, that there's something about it that like awakes some sort of feeling, or just like you feel differently than you ever have in your life after watching these films, and you just can't put your finger on it, but you know, like, that movie did that to you. This film felt that way for me. And I can't stop thinking about it since I saw it. So I thought it was a good one to talk about and see how you feel after you see it.
Hell yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it sounds right up my alley. Like I said, I mean, what year is this? It's 1969.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like I said at the beginning when we started talking, kind of like the way you view a film, about, I mean, just taking a step back and thinking of like the most pivotal like decades in film. I went to see a Buster Keaton movie actually at the Music Box a couple weeks ago, which was great. And just kind of like realizing like the 20s in the silent film era, how much of like that still like resonates in the film today.
Absolutely.
Like 100 years later, it's like the blueprint for everything. So it's like one of my favorite movies of the last decade was, I think by a long shot, was Mad Max Fury Road, which was essentially shot like a silent film. I mean, if it was up to him, like, he would have made like a silent film, because the storytelling in that is so aesthetically driven and just visual. That none of the story is really told through dialogue. And it was just making me realize just like how like the 20s and the 70s are arguably, you know, like this movie being like with that run in 1969, it's like the most pivotal decades for film.
I mean, you're right. And that's why Criterion put out 2 years ago or so German Expressionism kind of collection, right? And I watched all of those. They were all silent, right? Some of them were downright horrifying. Some of them were so emotional. Like even movies like the original Phantom of the Opera, with Lon Chaney, the original Lon Chaney. Like there's some truly like heartbreaking moments, you know, with like a person who's like a, you know, a monster and like terrorizing people and killing them. But like, what, you know, the soul of it and why he became that way. The story was told so much deeper without having to have any words, you know what I mean? And just it being all expression, you know? And I think that that's something that you don't get. Some actors, like, think about Karloff in Ed Wood, you know?
Yeah.
Or not Karloff, sorry, Lugosi, played by Martin Landau. Like, he knew how to really move his face to get the expression going. Some actors can do it, but back in those days, they had to do it because they didn't have a voice to express what they had to say.
I know. I think that's, again, I'm certainly no expert at silent film at all, but like it's, that's always what I respond to first whenever I do see one.
TCM, I don't have it anymore, but when I was in Chicago, I had, Turner Classic Movies, and they had a professor from Chicago starting to do Silent Sundays, I think it was. Jacqueline Stewart, I believe is her name. After Robert Osborne passed, they had a bunch of different like experts come on as hosts to do different things. And she was the Silent Sunday night person. Her name is Jacqueline Stewart, and she was very good. I wish I still had TCM to watch her.
Love it. Yeah. I haven't had cable in 15 years. So.
Totally. It came with the building, RCN, good old Chicago RCN.
That's the I think that's like the marketing tool that cable has now, comes with the building, because I think that's the majority of their
The best way that they can sell their goods.
What else I was watching, so we watched a couple more Joshua Burge movies.
I did, by the way. Can we talk about that for a second? I mean, Joshua Burge commented on our last episode of Remainders about Buzzard.
We were doing a little talking with Joshua Burge, friend of the show, seems like a really cool guy. We talked to him up big time in our last episode in Buzzard. I thought he was one of the best parts of that movie, his performance. And yeah, he was appreciative of us covering that. And so that was really cool to briefly chat with him. And then I ended up watching Relaxer, which is another Petraeus movie with Joshua Burge. And I definitely recommend that. And it sounded like you watched Ape.
Yep. So that's on my list, Relaxer. They got all of his movies on Criterion, thank God. Because I was like, as soon as we did Buzzard, I was like, I was like really stoked on that film. And then, you know, talking to Joshua, he couldn't have been nicer. Like the message that he wrote me was so nice. And just kind of like, we live close by, you're in the area, and you know, this, that, and the other thing, and kind of like was very personal about stuff. And I was like, damn, man, like, you know, thank you. Thanks for even taking a listen, you know, because we did, I said, we're big fans of his, and we are. And so because of that, I watched Ape, which I believe was their first film together, and what kind of got Petraeus on the map, which I loved at the end of the film. It says shot in on a Canon 6D or something like that. And I was like, yeah, this looks just like that. And, you know, again, I love that because it's like, you know, you get all in your head about what I talked about earlier with the Tarantino stuff, like, oh, I can't make a film because I don't have all the best gear and shit like that. They made Ape and it kicks ass, and you know, they didn't have to worry about all that shit, you know. There's a song that I added from that film, which is at the end of the thing, that I think you should check out, that you'd like. Let me just make sure I have it here. It's called Nervous Wreck by the Amoebas, and it's a band that it looks like, I added it 8 days ago, so it looks like I watched eight days ago. They have 265 monthly listeners. It looks like they had one record. It was a 2011 album. And, you know, they ended the film Ape with this song called Nervous Wreck, and it kicks ass. And it's always one of those things where it's like, I listen to like, you know, the songs that are on like TV shows or whatever. And I always like adding stuff to like, and this is one of them, and it's a great song. So if you got a chance, check it out. Nervous Wreck by the Amoebas.
Nice. Yeah. That's great. I mean, I think when I'm looking back, I mean, discovering music through film has been a consistent source of discovery for me, because it's endless the amount of stuff I've discovered. So I love that.
Film the great, you know, giver, gives you everything.
Love it.
We've realized is what was under the Silver Lake was just some good conversation.
Hey, oh, that was fantastic. I can always rely on you for, a nice wrapping up quip like that.
Yeah.
Anything
nice
else
bow on it.
Yeah. Anything else we're missing? Any music or?
I don't think so. I mean, I've been like loving the new Kanye West XXXTentacion song, True Love. Ridiculous Car, the song by Meat Wave, just came out that I fucking love. I love that band, Chicago Stalwarts. They're Logan Square peeps, if you want to say it that way. And then Rex Orange County, been killing it. New Panic at the Disco song came out. Loving the new Bayside song, Strangest Faces. And there's a new Murder by Death song called Never Be. Those are my go-tos right now, other than listening to my dad's 45s oldies playlist that I put together, which in my opinion is the best fucking playlist of all time. I mean, like 230 songs, 10 hours and 36 minutes. If you guys are followers of Spotify, this is like the coolest playlist. And I've been curating it from going to like awesome diners over time, where I'll hear a song on the radio. Oh, that's a kick-ass Ricky Nelson song I never heard, and I'll throw it into this playlist. Like, give yourself a good time and go listen to my dad's 45s oldies playlist. Cause like, that's all I do all night. I cook dinner and put this shit on, and it like makes me feel good.
Yeah. I've checked out that playlist, and it's, I can definitely attest to that. So,
and then after that, listen to our Remainders podcast, Warren Zevon playlist, which you curated, which is fucking awesome. I listen to that all the time.
Yeah, I actually did have that on last week.
I think it opens with Jesse James, and it's like, I don't know, it's a good opener, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Love it. Yeah, I saw him on something, maybe like one of his videos popped up. And that's usually how it is with like older artists like that, where you like a whole catalog. You just see one little reminder, and then you just kind of go down the rabbit hole listening to like the whole collection that you've heard 100 times before. So
totally. Yeah. I don't know. I think Zevon did maybe release like a remastered box set of something. And so like those have been popping up in my Spotify feeds too.
Oh, right on. Love it. Yeah, I got to check out, you had a portrait of him, didn't you? Last year.
Yeah. So like after the Remainders episode that we put out on Zevon, somebody had asked for do you like Zevon? And, you know, I was like, yeah, I did. Yeah. Fuck yeah. Who doesn't like Zevon? You know? And then I got on this tangent of talking to somebody about Warren Zevon, and that their husband was his favorite artist and her favorite artist as well. Would I be interested in doing a custom commission of Warren Zevon? And I was like, thank you, universe. Somebody finally asked me to do Warren Zevon. So yeah, I did. I think it was, you know, the Enjoy Every Sandwich moniker, right, that we put above them. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was fantastic. I loved seeing that. So
yeah, I love doing that one. I fucking love Warren Zevon, man.
He's up there for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. Should this do it for this episode of Remainders? I think I love this conversation. I mean, I don't hope you don't get discouraged. It's not like I didn't like this film. I did like it a lot, but I'm going to have to watch it probably like 20 more times to understand what it's about.
I've watched it 4 times and I still don't understand it. So, but no, there's no need. We're talking movies we like. You know, one of us may like it more than the other. But again, it's the collection that we're going in the direction of which is what I'm most excited about. And like we said, next week we'll be watching La Piscine, and so I'll be seeing that for the first time. Drop any comments on us. See if anybody likes it. Let us know what you were thinking about Under the Silver Lake too. Probably a little bit more harsh on that one. But yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing this one with you.
Awesome. Yeah, me too, Pat. Well, it's always good to see you talk movies. And yeah, everybody, let us know what's up. You know, is there something that you want us to see? We'll take some suggestions. Maybe there's a movie you and I have not seen at all, and we could just fly off the cuff. I'm down for that too.
Always love to experiment like that. Looking forward to it.
So, all right, man. Well, cool. I'll get this uploaded today, as I per usual do. And, you know, people can enjoy it over the weekend.
All right, man. Good talking to you.
You too. I'll talk to you next at the end of the month with La Piscine.
See you, bud.
All right. See you, Pat. Bye.